said.
God is God. Because He is God, He is worthy of my trust and obedience. I will find rest nowhere but in His holy will, a will that is unspeakably beyond my largest notions of what He is up to.
We're the station that is there for you, for the times when you see God working.
And the times when you have no idea what He is up to.
Hey, Bright.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour every weekday morning taking your phone calls. If you have the questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith that have been puzzling you and you want to ask them somewhere, you may call here and ask them on the air. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to bring that up for discussion, I'd be glad to hear you from you. I'd like to hear from you today too. Let me give you a phone number. And you can get through. The number is 800-227-5278. That number again is 800-227-5278. Our first caller in line today is Thale from St. Petersburg, Florida. Thale, welcome to the Narrow Path. And by the way, you call a lot. I don't know even if I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Is it Thale or Thale?
I guess most people call me Thale.
Thale. Okay, I'm going to try to remember that. I'm thinking of the Greek word theos, of course.
I don't mind.
Go ahead.
I've had many versions. Anyway, I had two questions related to the price of sin. So, I guess one is if the sacrifice of a lamb in the Old Testament or under the Old Covenant, I assume that was a prototype or a symbolism of the sacrifice that of the cost of our sins, which would be Jesus dying on the cross, I guess. And I just thought occurred to me that those people who argue for eternal conscious torment, it seems to me that when you sacrifice a lamb or the law to sacrifice a lamb, you weren't required to torment the lamb before sacrificing it. Or so forth, the price of the lamb was just the death of the lamb. I don't know if you would see that analogy to be valid. And a thought also occurred to me too. If the price of our sins is death, physical death, why do we still experience physical death?
And now that we're redeemed.
If Jesus paid the price of our sins, which is physical death, why do we still experience physical death?
Okay, well, let's work on that a little bit. The animal sacrifices, an animal died, it was not tormented, it just died, didn't feel anything afterward. Is that an exact parallel to humans when they die? Probably not. Some people think it is. Some people think that when humans die, they don't experience any other subsequent awareness of anything, except for those Christians who believe that in the resurrection, those who are sleeping in death will wake up and be alive again. But you're talking about hell. You're talking about, no doubt, being thrown into the lake of fire, I think. And you're coming against the idea that people in the lake of fire will experience eternal torment because an animal that's sacrificed does not do so. I think probably one thing that weakens that argument a little bit is that the animals are not an exact parallel. They are, in some respects, a parallel to our death. They do convey the idea that a death, blood has to be shed for sin. But there's not really any suggestion in the sacrificial system that everything about the picture parallels the reality. Now, perhaps closer to making your point would be the fact that the animal sacrifices foreshadow Christ's sacrifice, and his sacrifice is that of a human being, obviously, since he was human, not an animal, and therefore one could argue that his sacrifice would parallel, his death would parallel ours more, especially if he had the sins of the world laid upon him, as some passages seem to suggest. Then you'd think that he would be experiencing the ultimate penalty for all sin. Yet, it is argued by some, Jesus didn't suffer eternally. He was dead for 3 days, and then he came back and didn't suffer anymore. So that the penalty for all the world's sins borne by Christ was not eternal torment, but simply death and a few days in the grave. Now, some people, the ones who argue for eternal torment, like to suggest, well, maybe Jesus didn't suffer infinitely in length of time, but maybe infinitely in intensity. Maybe his suffering was of infinite intensity, so that what it didn't require in terms of extension of prolongation of punishment, it was all suffered in a very short time because he bore infinitely more pain and suffering than we. Well, this is only a theory. The Bible doesn't say anything like that. The Bible doesn't say that Jesus bore infinitely more than we do, and therefore it would only be somebody's guess. It would be one way of trying to reconcile the fact that the penalty of sin would be eternal torment on the view of the traditional view, and Jesus didn't seem to suffer eternal torment, did not certainly suffer eternal torment. So they would say, well, we can reconcile that by having his death infinitely intense, his suffering. But there's no record in the Bible that Jesus' suffering was infinitely intense, or that it was so much greater than other human suffering that it would make up the difference between 3 days and eternity of punishment. So, you know, the animal sacrifice you mentioned as an example does point forward to the sacrifice of Christ, and his death would seemingly have much to do with the penalty of sin, since that's what he died for. And it would raise serious questions about the validity of eternal torment, especially in view of the fact that the Bible always says the wages of sin is death. The soul that sins will die. Adam and Eve were told that when they eat the fruit of the wrong tree, that in the day they eat it, they'll die. And no one is ever told that if they sin, they'll be tormented forever, neither in the Old or the New Testament is anyone preached at with that kind of a threat, or any epistle telling us, or Jesus teaching us that, you know, if a person sins, they're going to be tormented forever. So that doctrine is traditional, and if it is true, it is not very much clearly taught in the Bible. And your other point was related to, I forget now what it was. What was your second point, Theo?
Why do we still experience physical death?
Well, yeah, why do we experience physical death? Yeah. Well, we experience physical death because the body is still fallen. And because we do not have access physically to the tree of life, which if Adam and Eve had eaten it, or if we ate it, we would live forever, according to Genesis 3. But we physically do not have access to that tree. Now, the tree was, I think, a type and a shadow of Christ. And we have received eternal life, but not in the physical realm. We will, in the resurrection, we will be redeemed from death in that sense, physically, in the resurrection of the last day. In the meantime, we've only had a spiritual resurrection. We've passed from death into life, and therefore our bodies have not been redeemed. Paul said that in Romans 8, in this body we are groaning, awaiting the redemption of our body. So he said that Christians have not yet had the redemption of our bodies, that we have been redeemed from sin. Our bodies have yet to experience the redemption from mortality.
I guess the confusion then is what's the one-to-one comparison of what Jesus paid and what we would not have to pay?
Well, we don't know. I mean, the Bible doesn't really clarify that.
Okay.
But we are exempted from the second death, and that seems to be the ultimate punishment of the sinner, is the second death. mentioned in Revelation chapter 20, which is the lake of fire. And so we have been redeemed from death, not from physical death, although we will even have that redemption from physical death in the resurrection. But we have been saved in a sense that unsaved people have not been from the second death. It says, blessed are those who have part in the first resurrection. On them the second death has no power. And so that's the ultimate redemption from death for us.
Okay. That's very good. I think it's something to mull over.
All right, Bill. Good talking to you. Bye now. Okay, our second caller is Richard from Thousand Oaks, California. Richard, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Can you explain to me what reformed means and what reformed people believe? Does their belief, their whatever, like, belief, I guess, include partial preterism, or do you know? And if you know, would you kind of fill me in a little bit on what they believe and who they are? Thank you very much, and I'll get off here and listen to you on my radio.
Okay. Thank you. Well, reformed theology refers to that branch of Protestant Christianity that follows the teachings of John Calvin, principally. And therefore, the Calvinistic doctrines are part of Reformed theology, and sometimes that's the main thing that people think of. When they think of Reformed theology, they're often thinking of Calvin's predestination doctrines and so forth. That certainly is a major part of Reformed theology. But when it comes to eschatology, or the view of final things, Reformed theology also differs from the popular premillennial and dispensational view that is so common outside of Reformed churches. Reformed churches believe either in amillennialism or postmillennialism. Either one, either amillennialism or postmillennialism are compatible with the Reformed theology. And you'll find, for example, Presbyterian churches are of the Reformed camp. Dutch Reformed, Christian Reformed, these are different denominations that are Reformed. There's even Reformed Baptist, or Baptist Reformed. These would be churches that, if they're Reformed, they mean they're Calvinistic. But the older Presbyterian and Reformed denominations are also amillennial, and some of them are postmillennial, because the two views are very, very similar to each other in some respects. So amillennialism or postmillennialism are both compatible with Reformed theology and can be found among the Reformed denominations. Preterism, which is a view of the book of Revelation that sees Revelation as fulfilled in the past, is compatible with Reformed theology, but is not a necessary part of it. Reformed people can accept any view of the book of Revelation. They can accept the futurist view, though they rarely do. They can accept the idealist view, which many of them do. Some very good books on the idealist view have arisen from the Dutch Reformed camp. The historicist view is the view that Calvin himself held. He held the historicist view, which Luther also did, and many people did up until the late 19th century. And then, of course, preterism is also commonplace among Reformed churches. So preterism is the view that Revelation was talking about, AD 70, the destruction of Jerusalem. So a person might be in a Reformed church and find there people who take Revelation in an idealist way, and other people who take it in a historicist way, not very common anymore, and other people still who take the book of Revelation in a preterist way. And all of them would be equally welcomed, I would expect, in a Reformed denomination. All right, so I hope that answers your question. Diana from Laguna Woods is our next caller, and we have a line open for you, more than one, actually, if you'd like to call now. The number is 800-227-5278. If you'd like to be on the program today, this is the number. It is 800-227-5278. My name is Steve Gregg, and you're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. You're welcome to call with questions about the Bible or points of disagreement if you wish. 800-227-5278 is the number. Diana, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. First question is very quick. Does the Bible anywhere give the name of Noah's wife?
No.
Okay. And then I met a woman at a coffee shop who had a Star of David around her neck, although she said she's been a believer for the last 20 years. She asked me if there were two Passovers. I didn't know the second one, except to say that on the day of Pentecost, I think the Jews were all gathered. The reason there were so many there is that they were celebrating Passover. But is there another Passover that I don't know about?
Well, I'm not sure what she's asking. I'm not sure what she means by two Passovers. There is a day of the month, 14th of Nisan, which is called the Passover, and that's the night that they eat the Passover lamb. And that whole festival of that evening is called the Passover. And,
right.
and yet there's 7 days of unleavened bread after the Passover, and sometimes the entire week, including the Passover evening and the 7 days of unleavened bread, the whole week is sometimes called Passover as well, just another manner of speaking. These are not two different Passovers. These are not two different Passovers, but two different ways that the word Passover can be used. It can refer only to the individual day of the Paschal ceremony, or it can be a reference to the entire week, which includes the 7 days of unleavened bread. Now, I don't know if that's what she was referring to, or she has something else in mind. I don't know if she's thinking, well, is there a Jewish Passover and a Christian Passover? Since she's a believer and wears the Star of David, maybe she thinks there's a Passover that she, as a Jew, would celebrate and another Passover that she, as a Christian, would celebrate, but that's not the case. In the New Testament, the Jewish Passover was taken up by Christ and given new meaning, and he didn't indicate that his disciples would ever again celebrate the Passover in the Jewish way. In fact, he said, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, which would be the Passover bread and cup, as often as you do it, you remember me. You show forth the Lord's death until he comes. And so he's saying that you will no longer celebrate the Passover in the Jewish manner. You'll now celebrate it in remembrance of me rather than as a remembrance of the Exodus.
Thank you. That's really good. Now, the next one is a little more difficult, but I'll try to make it brief, and then I'll listen on the air, off the air. She got into the spiritual conversation, which was good up to a point, and then she began tearing down one of the local pastors, and she didn't know in the beginning, it's my pastor in the church I go to, but she had a YouTube video on her smartphone that she wanted me to see, that I had never heard such horrible attacks on this pastor, all very negative things and things I know are not true. But she kept saying, they're documented. And so I wondered how you would suggest I handle it, other than, of course, first of all, first defense is pray, praying for her. And for anyone else watching the YouTube, I also directed her to your program, and she did seem interested and took the information down. But beyond that, I didn't feel that I need to vindicate the pastor, but the only thing I could think of is to say that if someone told me negative things about her, I would not just accept it. I would want to go to her, the source, and would suggest that she would listen to this pastor and then make up her own mind and not listen to all these horrible charges.
Yeah, well, depending on what the charges are, she might not be able to tell whether they're true or not by listening to him, because a man might have a very good ability to preach and still have some skeletons in his closet. However, I agree with you. You shouldn't accept an accusation against him just because someone posted one on YouTube. Anyone can post something on YouTube. And the Apostle Paul told Timothy, do not receive an accusation against an elder except by the mouth of two or more witnesses. Now, an elder would include a pastor, and if someone makes an accusation against a pastor, you should not believe it unless there's two or more witnesses. And witnesses would be people who actually know firsthand that the accusations are correct, not just that they'd heard it and now they're repeating it. the thing, the YouTube video is only really takes one person to post a YouTube video, and they may be the only person who claims to know about this. In fact, they may not be witnesses themselves. They may be only suspicious. So you need to be very careful about that. I mean, any pastor can be maligned by anyone publicly on the Internet now. On the other hand, if there are multiple witnesses, I mean, maybe the video actually has many witnesses that are, I don't know the pastor and I don't know what the charges are, but if there are multiple witnesses to the charge, then that is something I would definitely want to approach the pastor about and ask him about it. And maybe, you know, if I wasn't very satisfied with the answer, I might have to go somewhere else. I don't know. Anyway, those would be my counsel to you about that. Let's talk next to who's been here longest. Looks like Dan from Los Angeles. Dan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, I want to talk about that last caller. There are some real disturbing videos of the preachers themselves. These are preachers I formerly respected. And we hear them saying things under their breath where they don't think they're being picked up by the microphone that are incredibly disturbing, heretical, and I stopped supporting them. So, yes, the mouths of two or three witnesses, one or two cameras, and the camera, if it is not altered, is the recorded phenomena. So I think this is the fulfillment of Daniel. We're going to see government, corrupt people, and people in the church exposed, and we can't hide our eyes because we're going to be held accountable if we support corrupt ministers.
Well, there certainly are plenty of ministers who can be condemned by their own words, and that's what Jesus said, by your words you'll be justified, by your words you'll be condemned.
Paul said we have to consider everything, and if we have evidence that a minister is false, we got to look at that evidence. We can't turn our eyes.
Now, but many people will accuse a minister, and they'll have a video of him saying something, but his words are sufficiently ambiguous that he might mean something very innocent, but maybe there's some words in his quote that they don't like, and so they may want to be teaching something else. That happens, too.
But in the case of Joel Osteen, when they challenged him and he had a chance to respond, he couldn't really defend his reason for excluding the word Jesus Christ from his book. And I made a decision with many others to totally stay away from Joel Osteen because he's afraid to use the word Jesus Christ. So I think he is a false minister.
Well, I'm not denying that there are false ministers. I'm not denying that at all. I'm simply saying we have to be fair-minded in evaluating evidence. If someone shows a video on YouTube and there's an ambiguous statement without context, I mean, for example, very, very famously on YouTube, there's a video that's been there for a long time of Billy Graham being interviewed by Robert Schuller. And Billy Graham speaks rather, I would say, ambiguously, in a way that some people think he's saying that people can be saved without Jesus. And yet, as I understand his words, I don't see it necessary to take them that way. I see people who are just looking for faults in many cases, and they'll take something a man says, and they don't quite understand what he's saying, but they take it in the most uncharitable way. And then
I think there's a better
he's a heretic
here. I think we hold government leaders to a higher standard than we do Christian ministers who we support, and that's got to stop. If something's going to expose a corrupt leader on YouTube, why can't it be applied to Christian leaders? We're supposed to be of higher moral standard. So I encourage people, consider everything.
Well, I agree, and I agree that even with reference to political leaders, I mean, you can't believe everything that's said about them either. You have to find out if it's true before you pass it along, and that's true. And you're right, I think Christian ministers need to be held to a higher standard than political leaders. Is that what you called on?
I agree.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thank you. All right, let's talk to Jim from La Mirada. Jim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I was at your Buena Park lecture, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I wanted to find out what your views are on soul sleep and annihilation.
Well, I think a case can be made for annihilation, and I think a case can be made for soul sleep. I would consider that the case for annihilation would be stronger than the case for soul sleep, though I'm not entirely persuaded of the case. I'm just saying, looking at the number of verses and the kinds of verses that are used to support it, I think it could be argued that annihilation has a pretty good argument on its side. It's not the only view that has a pretty good argument on its side, though, and there are alternative views that could also be argued rather strongly. So I respect people who believe in annihilation because I know the nature of the arguments that they can use, and I realize that it is not not a weak argument. It may have weaknesses, but it is not a very weak argument. All arguments for all views have some weaknesses, and I would say that's true of annihilation, but they're not fatal necessarily. Now, as far as soul sleep, I don't think the arguments for soul sleep are quite as strong. Largely, I mean, there are references to people, the dead know nothing in Ecclesiastes 9, and Jesus and Paul spoke about people who had died as being asleep. I don't consider Ecclesiastes to be a book of doctrine. I consider it to be a Solomon telling his testimony of things he used to believe, which he's come around. The book of Ecclesiastes is largely Solomon telling what he thought and what he did when he was away from God. And therefore, when he says a certain thing, especially when he prefaces it, as he does that whole chapter, with the words, "I considered in my heart," and then he goes on, and at one point, the thing he considered in his heart was that the dead know nothing. Well, that's what he considered, but he's not saying that's necessarily true. He's talking about what he used to believe when he was away from God. And so I don't argue any kind of doctrine from Ecclesiastes. The idea that Jesus called death sleep, and that Paul did also, suggests that there is something like sleep that suggests that metaphor. And many people think that what death resembles sleep in is it being an unconscious condition. However, while death might be an unconscious condition, sleep isn't, so it would not make a very good metaphor. If we're trying to say death is unconscious, we'd be better off just calling it death rather than sleep, because sleep is not an unconscious state. The mind is still active, brain, you know, we have dreams and so forth. So sleep would be a terrible metaphor if someone's trying to get across the idea that death is unconsciousness, because sleep is not. But there's other ways in which death might resemble sleep. For example, sleep is temporary. When you go to bed and go to sleep, you have no doubt that you'll wake up in the morning. Some people don't wake up, but the point is you expect to. Sleep normally is temporary. You wake up from it. And death also is temporary, because there will be a resurrection from which the dead will arise. And I think that is the way in which death is being compared with sleep in the metaphor of sleep which Jesus used and Paul. In fact, every time they spoke of it as sleep, they were talking about raising the dead. And that's, I think, perhaps indicative of something. I'm out of time, unfortunately. I apologize to those I didn't get to. There's quite a few callers waiting, maybe tomorrow. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio expenses to stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from our website if you go there, and there's lots of resources there. They're all free. It's at thenarrowpath.com. Check it out. It's thenarrowpath.com. You can take anything there for free, or you can donate there too. Have a good day. Let's talk again tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
Just about 10 in the morning and you are tuned into KBRT. Thanks so much to Mac from Mission Viejo for giving $200 to Save the Storks. This ministry provides local pregnancy resource centers with a mobile medical clinic called a Stork Bus, a free high-definition ultrasound to abortion-minded women at abortion clinics at college so they can actually see their child. I'm Rob Newton. You must listen to this story.
KBRT supports and encourages organizations that provide ultrasounds to women considering an abortion because it's been proven to save lives. Most of the women who see the ultrasound of their unborn child decide against an abortion. Here's an actual story from a woman named Jamie.
I thought that if I scheduled the abortion for a Saturday, I wouldn't see anyone outside of the clinic. I had heard that there could be protesters there, and I did not want to deal with them. The reason I was choosing to abort this time was because I had already had so many children, and I could not imagine having one more. Once parked, a very nice older lady told me that I could get a free pregnancy test and ultrasound, and she pointed me to a van that was parked down the drive. I was curious, but I did not want anyone to try to talk me out of it. I told her I would do the ultrasound, but I had already made up my mind. As soon as the wand was placed on my stomach and I saw the clear picture of what seemed like a very large baby, I was overwhelmed. I was not prepared for what immediately came over me when